welcome to the program. Every day we push further into the brave new world of science and genetic engineering. As we do so, we provide new cures for once fatal diseases. But we also raise rather troubling and profound ethical questions that doctors, families, and societies must struggle with long after the treatment is administered. We're going to talk about one such set of circumstances this morning with my guest, Beth Whitehouse. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for Newsday. She's an adjunct professor of journalism at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Her front page series, The Match, is the basis for her current book. It is my pleasure to have Beth Whitehouse here to talk about The Match, Save Your Siblings, and One Family's Battle to Heal Their Daughter. Beth Whitehouse, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Good to have you here. Tell us, first of all, what a save your sibling is.
Okay, a save your sibling is a term that was coined to describe a child who is selected through testing the embryos before the embryos are implanted in the mother's womb. So a couple goes through in vitro fertilization, just like anyone else would go through in vitro fertilization. And instead of implanting the embryos on that look good on day three, doctors actually, or embryologists actually, take one cell from each embryo and send it off to a geneticist who then tests the cell to see which would be a bone marrow match for a sick sibling who needs a bone marrow donation to be cured of a disease. So they then tell the fertility doctor which embryos to implant in the uterus. They implant those embryos and hope that the mother gets pregnant. That child that's born is then called the savior sibling because his or her bone marrow or umbilical cord blood can be used to then cure the sibling.
How long has the science existed to be able to do this?
The first child that was born documented after this procedure was born in 2000. So he is now 9 years old. That's the Nash family in Colorado. So to be able to successfully create a savior sibling is about, 10 years old now. But it wasn't, it was gotten more and more successful, and the numbers have increased, and the doctors are doing more now than they have before. There's probably an estimate. Nobody keeps track of this. There's no organization that knows exactly how many of these children there are, but the estimates from the doctors who primarily do it here and in Europe, I found that there is about probably 250 such children in the world.
And is there a sense, do you have a sense of how successful these procedures have been in terms of helping save the existing sibling?
Again, nobody knows because the technology uses three different sets of doctors. First, you have the fertility doctors who do the in vitro fertilization. Then you have the geneticists who test the embryos to find out which are matches. Then the child is born and in the umbilical cord blood is saved, and in the best case scenario they don't actually do anything to the save your sibling. They just use the umbilical cord blood to give a bone marrow transplant to the sick child. In some cases, like the case in my book, they did have to use the bone marrow. So when the baby was 1 year old, they took bone marrow from his hips and put it into his sister. But because the ending set of the bone marrow transplant is done by a different hospital and bone marrow doctors, there's no one tracking this, so we don't really know how many of the savior children are born that actually go ahead and are used for a bone marrow transplant, how many of those transplants are successful. We only really have anecdotal evidence, but obviously it's working to enough of an extent that more and more families are using this, and Dr. Mark Hughes, who's the main doctor in the United States who does most of the HLA, that's the bone marrow matching, said he's now doing about close to 4 cases a week of testing for families, and 1 week this year he actually tested 11 cases. So
when this procedure began, when back in 2000, when this process of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis began, was there initially any objection to it? Was it below the radar? Was there any pushback to the idea of doing this?
I still think it's a little bit below the radar, although Jodi Picoult's book, My Sister's Keeper, which a lot of people say, uh-huh, oh, isn't this that same story, brought it a lot more into the spotlight. However, in an exaggerated worst-case scenario. So some of the doctors who do this are frustrated with the fact that the way most people know about it is through this movie that actually is fiction, which a lot of people don't realize. It's not true. The person in the movie was 13 years old who, in the movie, the savior child sues her parents for medical emancipation
right.
because they want her to give a kidney. And that's just not the truth. The oldest child, as I said, is only 9, so that scenario can't even happen yet. And Jodie Picoult, who's interviewed in my book, says that even she would do it if she had a child and needed one. So I think there's some objection. I know that but it's been under the radar. The objections are theoretical and sort of worried about what people call a slippery slope, that if we start to test embryos for certain traits that are not of medical use to that particular embryo, meaning that the savior sibling doesn't get anything out of it beyond curing the sister, you know, do we start to then open the door for people to choose traits like height and eye color and hair color, which of course geneticists can't do yet, but will probably be able to do sometime in the future. So I think that most doctors I've talked to are fine with having a bone marrow match created, and I know that surveys have showed that most people are okay with that, too. And even some people think that if you have the ability to do that, you have an obligation medically to do that to save the other child. I think the objection comes when people are worried about potential abuse of the use of testing embryos, for reasons that are not health-related. Already people are using it to test because they want a boy or a girl baby. That has nothing to do with health, but they have two boys and they want to guarantee that their next child is a girl, or virtually guarantee, and they have two girls and they want to guarantee a boy. And there are people who definitely object to using this technology for non-medical reasons, simply for preference.
Tell us the story of the Trebbings, which is the family that you write about in the match.
Mm-hmm. The Trebbings had had one healthy child, and their second child, when she was born, they thought was also healthy. But a few hours after her birth, it was obvious that Katie Trebbing was not healthy. She was having trouble breathing. Her hemoglobin count was low, which meant her body wasn't getting oxygen to the organs. They diagnosed her with diamond black fan anemia, which is a very rare disease that her body would never make red blood cells, and red blood cells carry the oxygen throughout the body to nourish the organs. She had to have a blood transfusion every month or more for the rest of her life in order to give her someone else's red blood cells. And with that continued blood transfusion, iron builds up in the heart and in the liver and eventually breaks down the organs. So the doctors told the Trebbings that there was that the current statistics at that point showed that more than 40% of those people did not live through their 40s. And that was just not acceptable to them, and they implored the doctors for some kind of cure. Couldn't they do anything? And when the doctors told them about the possibility of creating a third child who could be the bone marrow match for Katie, they were ecstatic. To them, it was a miracle of science that could, you know, be applied to a family and help a family have a happy, happy ending, which the Trebbings did have. So they felt like they were doubly blessed to get to have a third child who could also save their second child.
Were there questions that they had about, A, the process, and, B, the fact that they would be having this third child essentially as this savior sibling?
As far as the second part of your question, I don't think they saw it as having the child essentially. I mean, I know they didn't see it as having the child essentially to save the second sibling. They always wanted a third child. They thought they were going to have to put that off because they were worried about Katie's treatments, and they were also worried about the fact that their third child could also have this disease. So this to them was like a gift. They didn't have any problem with having a third child, and I know that they don't see it as that's the reason for his existence. It's more like the icing on the cake for them. And then as far as the procedure itself, they did worry about whether taking a cell off an embryo at that form stage of development would harm the child later in his life. But number one, there wasn't a lot at that point when they were going through it. There was only maybe 50 to 100 donor children in the world, and there was no list of them that they could call or support group or any place to ask. So they really didn't have a way to answer those questions. Most studies have shown, the doctors say, that there's no added risk, birth defects or risks to having a cell taken off an embryo. So the main problem that the Trebbings faced that they had struggled with was whether or not to have a bone marrow transplant, because that procedure was perilous for Katie. She could have, you know, she had a 90% chance of cure, but the other 10% chance was that she would die. So one out of 10 kids that has a bone marrow transplant from an exact match sibling doesn't make it. And we know families that have had bone marrow transplants from exact match siblings and it didn't work. So, you know, and they died or they're, you know, not doing well. So the Trebbings are very cautious to say that this is their story that had a great ending and hopefully other people's would too. But their main concern was whether to go ahead with the bone marrow transplant, and that caused them the most anguish.
How did their family and friends deal with what they were doing, and how did they explain it to them?
The Trebbings have always been extremely open because they have three reasons why they wanted to do this. You know, they don't make a penny from this book or anything. They are doing this to give back from what they feel they were given. They want people to donate to the Diamondback Van Anemia Foundation to try to help cure Diamondback Van Anemia. They want to encourage people to give blood because that saved their daughter's life up until the point she could have the bone marrow transplant. They want people to learn about the PGD, which is the pre-implantation genetics diagnosis, which the doctor who does that, who's very active in doing that, is at genesisgenetics.org, Dr. Mark Hughes, and they want people to know about it. This testing can also be used, by the way, and was first developed to detect diseases in families, childhood inherited diseases. So if your family has you know, cystic fibrosis or sickle cell anemia or some other disease in the family that you carry, you can try to ensure that your next child won't have it. So they want people to know about that. Their family was very supportive. I mean, everybody knows Katie and their family, obviously, and when you see a little girl, you know, and she was like 18 months old at the time they started doing this, and she'd had more blood transfusions than anybody in the room, and anyone that most people knew, and she, you know, had to have a nightly needle as well in her thigh to try to inject a drug that would get rid of some of the iron in her body. So every five nights a week for 10 hours, she had to be hooked to this pump and get a needle in her thigh. I think people wanted to see her cured. And most people said to the Trebbings, you know, we're not walking in your shoes, and, you know, we're glad we're not, and we'll support whatever decision that you make. And the family and friends rallied together, had a fundraiser, a huge fundraiser, to try to help them pay for all this because insurance doesn't cover much of the costs that they had to do this for the IVF and the PGD and also for all their costs associated with the bone marrow transplant that weren't covered by insurance. So the family and friends tried to really support them in any way they could.
Talk about that for a few minutes. What was the insurance company's attitude towards all of this?
Well, the IVF, it depends on your insurance, whether you are covered for that or not. Most people are not, or they have maybe a $10,000 rider, and this costs much more. The Trebbings spent about $35,000 to $40,000 to have Christopher. The PGD costs $3,500. It's subsidized by the Claudia Hughes Foundation, which is a foundation that raises money so that they can charge only $3,500 to do this complicated genetic testing that takes two scientists, you know, 19 hours to do in the laboratory. And they, you know, the bone marrow transplant was covered by their insurance, but there was a lot of out-of-pocket costs associated with it in terms of driving back and forth to Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital, staying in the city, paying for co-payments, drugs, fertility medication, et cetera. So, and the insurance company wasn't always you know, cooperative with where they exactly wanted to go, and there's a chapter about their struggle with that in the book as well.
Tell us a little bit about the success of this procedure. What happened?
Okay, so when the Trebbings decided to go ahead with the bone marrow transplant, they found out that the doctors thought that it would be more successful in Katie's case if they used Christopher, who is the new child, his bone marrow instead of just his umbilical cord blood, which they had frozen at his birth and which was really just waste and would have been thrown away otherwise. The doctors felt that because there were some complicated reasons why it would work better for Katie. So they used the bone marrow for Katie. And so for Christopher, it was just one day in the hospital. He came in, he had he was put under anesthesia. He had bone marrow taken from his hips, and several hours later, he was running around the recovery room. He did great. There were risks to him of any risks that happen with any kind of a procedure like this, adverse reaction to the anesthesia, post-procedure infection, but none of that happened. I saw him the day after the transplant, and he was crawling around with his brother, and he just had a bandage across his back. So he was done and, you know, and doing great. Katie had to be in the hospital for 37 days. She was in the hospital. The first 10 days were chemotherapy, which caused, you know, causes all the side effects of chemotherapy. Her hair fell out. She got mouth sores, nausea, you know, all the things that happened from chemo. Then she got the bone marrow transplant, and the first 2 weeks afterwards were the most dangerous for her, because to give someone bone marrow, even from an exact match sibling, you have to wipe out their immune system so that it doesn't reject the bone marrow. But a side effect of that is that the immune system can't fight anything. So she was very susceptible to any kind of infection. Even if she got a common cold, it could have raged out of control and killed her. So that was very dangerous. That was the most dangerous part. But she did well also. She didn't have, she had some mild graft versus host disease, which is when the donor's marrow attacks the body. So she had some rashes from that. But she basically recovered as well as could be expected. And she had a year-long recovery at home, during which she had to also be sort of isolated from other people, very careful about what she ate, where she went, being exposed to germs. But then she has, she's now considered cured of the deadly part of the disease, the part that makes her have to have monthly blood transfusions, and she has hopefully a prognosis for long, healthy life, where her quality of life will be better because she doesn't have to go to the hospital anymore every month. And it's really quite amazing when you see the Christopher and Katie running around, and you think Christopher's bone marrow is inside Katie's body functioning. And she's, you know, able to now make her own red blood cells.
Talk about what the parents have talked about in terms of what they will eventually tell these kids as they're old enough to understand what's transpired.
They tell the kids little by little what they think they can understand. Christopher, of course, is only 4 right now. He's going to be 5, actually, in about a week. And so he doesn't understand about conception, that kind of stuff, and they haven't talked to the kids about that at this point. What they basically told them is that that Katie had needed healthy blood, that her blood was sick, because that's easier for the kids to visualize in bone marrow, and essentially the same concept, and that Christopher needed to give Katie some of his good blood so that she could get better. So that's what they will say. If you talk to them, Katie will say, my brother saved my life. He gave me his blood. She's 7 years old now and in first grade and the cutest little thing. And Christopher will say, and, you know, somewhat proudly, I got needles in my back. I gave Katie my blood. And I think he senses that he did this kind of heroic thing that everyone thinks is wonderful. So that's what they know right now, and that's the way it's been presented to them.
One of the questions beyond the slippery slope argument that you alluded to before in terms of what this can lead to and with regard to choices people might want to make, what are the other ethical questions that doctors and medical ethicists raise about this?
Well, there's the question of the embryos, you know, that you're creating embryos that may or, you know, may not be used that are healthy but don't meet the needs that you need for the donor child. But Dr. Mark Hughes says we always select embryos in IVF. You're selecting an embryo as well. So everyone who does IVF has the same issue where they have excess embryos that are healthy that aren't used. So that's one issue that's hotly debated in this country because of the whole contentious sort of disagreement about when life begins and what rights we have to manipulate the randomness of birth and that issue. So that's one thing. The other thing is the idea that we are even selecting out disease, some people have issues with, although not so many, that, you know, we're eliminating, you know, what should we eliminate? How much should we eliminate? England now has a list of 116 because they have to get permission to do pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Here it's not regulated at all. They have a list of 116 disorders and diseases and deep birth defects, things that are inherited that they can can go ahead and test for without having to ask permission. Some of those occur later in life. We're testing now for the breast cancer gene, for example, and you may not get breast cancer until you're in your 40s. So should we then be eliminating these kind of things? They're testing for diseases that cause blindness. That's not life-threatening. However, it does affect quality of life. Should we be testing and selecting embryos for that? So there's that debate over how much to be able to select. And then, of course, the slippery slope of will we start to select for traits? And there was a doctor in California, Dr. Jeffrey Steinberg, who in 2009 placed an ad on his website saying that he would help people test for preferred eye color and skin tone, and he could only do it in certain people with certain genetic makeup, and it would only give them like a percentage, like he could say this embryo has a high percentage of having green eyes, etc. The media went crazy. Doctors vilified him for doing this. He backpedaled, and he's also interviewed in my book. He says he doesn't think that people were ready for it at this point, and he's not going to do that, but I don't know what people, you know, what will happen in the future in terms of when doctors are more able to do this.
And because Christopher and Katie are this perfect genetic match, what about the possibility and what's ever been discussed about the possibility of what their needs might be down the road?
Now, Katie will most likely never need anything from Christopher again. The whole idea that, oh, you're going to need to go after this person for a kidney, as I said, Jodi Picoult and My Sister's Keeper, she says she needed to ratchet up the stakes. She picked one of the most aggressive forms of leukemia for the child to have in the book, and that's why that child needed repeated donations from the sibling. But that is just one disease in the whole spectrum of diseases that can be treated by this. And so Katie's disease, she should not ever need anything else from Christopher.
Beth Whitehouse, her book is The Match, Save Your Siblings and One Family's Battle to Heal Their Daughter. It is just out from Beacon Press. Beth, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Thank you.
And it's such a happy ending in this book, so I hope that people read it and see the way that science can help families.
Thank you.